Hello, everybody. This is Lee Tooley hosting Reality Check, and this week we have with us Denise Juarez, who is a senior recruitment specialist, volunteer services of the American Red Cross. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Lee.
I am so glad you're here because ever since I've been a little kid, every time there's something going on in the news, the Red Cross is there. Isn't that their slogan? The Red Cross is there?
Yeah, well, we will be there.
And yet, I consider myself fairly well informed. I really don't know too much about the Red Cross, only that you take care of emergencies. Can you say a little bit about the big picture of the Red Cross?
Yes. So we actually have five lines of service, so five different things that we concentrate on.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to start probably with the ones that you know the least.
Okay.
So we have international services. We provide measles vaccines in third world countries.
Oh.
For children in third world countries. And then we also have a program called Restoring Family Links, where we reconnect families who have been separated due to conflict or disaster. So we try to help them get back together.
Oh, great.
Then we have our health and safety courses. Of course, we teach CPR, first aid, lifeguarding, babysitting. We have a number of classes to help people be prepared in their community for if someone should collapse in front of them, they'll know what to do to help that person and keep them alive until EMTs can get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our service to the armed forces, which is where we began. So we provide emergency messaging to military members and their families. What we do for the Army base or for the armed forces is we are the people who make sure that we check to see that that event actually occurred. So when a service member has a family member who's ill or something, they call us. We verify that that event is occurring through third parties like doctors or whomever it may be, and then we let the commander know.
Uh-huh.
The commander then determines if the service member gets to come home for that event, and we'll help them get home if they need to. We also have volunteers in every military hospital, every VA hospital. We help with reconnection workshops for soldiers who've been deployed. When they get home, we have these small group workshops for them and their families.
So sort of a reentry thing?
Yeah, so uh-huh. They can reconnect and learn to speak to each other again. And, you know, they've been in two different worlds, so we're trying to get them back together.
Sounds really important.
It is very important. And then we have our blood services. So we collect about 40% of the nation's blood supply. We, of course, don't collect blood everywhere, but we do here in the Pacific Northwest. I know we have regular blood things here in Brookings. So we need volunteers for that who can help. We call them blood ambassadors. They're there to greet the people who are donating blood. They make sure that they eat their snacks when they leave. But we also need transportation specialists who can take blood from here to one of our blood centers so that it can get to Portland to be tested. All blood has to be tested. And then also, once the blood's been tested, getting it back to the hospital. So we'll have transportation specialists to actually take that blood to the hospitals.
Hmm.
Then we have our disaster services, which is, of course, what you're seeing on the news now with Michael and Florence and that kind of stuff. But just to let you know, the most common disaster is a house fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we respond to house fires pretty much every day. Well, every day of the year, we respond to a house fire.
And that would be even individual houses. It doesn't have to be a big conflagration like we've had lately.
It's just an individual house fire is
wow.
What the most common disaster is. And I get that people think, oh, a disaster is something that happens to a lot of people. But a house fire to that family is a disaster.
For sure.
And they've lost everything. So our volunteers there, what we do is we get a call from the fire department or police department or someone, and then those we have a dispatcher who calls our volunteers who are closest to that incident. We pride on ourselves on getting there within an hour, and they sit on the curb with that family. They give them a hug. They tell them, you know, what their next steps are going to be. We ask the family if they have lodging, and if they don't, we provide a client assistance card with some money for lodging and food and clothing. Now, it's only going to cover 2 to 3 days. We can't, we're not trying to make them whole or get them back to where they were. We're trying to get them through the initial disaster.
Just to fill the gap until they can get themselves together.
Right. And to help them, give them a little breathing room till they can say, okay, what am I going to do next? What are my next steps? And we'll even talk them through that. We have caseworkers who'll help them with that. If they need other resources in the community, we'll help them to find those resources. So that is what our volunteers do in that setting. But then they also train those volunteers to go to like Florence or Michael or Reading when the fires were happening there. Or even when they opened the shelters here for the Chetco Bar fire. We go where we're asked to go, so the local government has to invite us or ask us to open a shelter, and we'll do that. We have lots of partners in that, too. You know, we get people, different people to provide food. I know in Florence, Southern Baptists have helped us with the providing the meals, and they have huge semi-trucks that have ovens and stuff in them so they can get a lot of meals done quickly at one time. We partner with a lot of different people in different places to get those things done, but we are the experts in providing the sheltering piece of that. So opening a shelter, staffing those shelters, making sure that people have what they need as far as medical supplies maybe or things like that.
When you say we, I'm pulling people into, say, a disaster relief program or something of that nature, you're talking about volunteers primarily?
Yes.
I mean, you've got some staff, obviously, but you're going to have a majority of participants or volunteers?
Right. The American Red Cross is 90% volunteers. So, like, in Florence, I think we had like 3,000 volunteers. We actually have quite a few volunteers deployed there from here, but they're pretty much all volunteers. We do have some staff, but we try to keep that to minimum because we want to most of our donor dollars to go to direct services. And some staff provide those, but the more volunteers that we can get involved, the better we are, even locally. So, like, we have volunteers who deployed from Gold Beach to South Carolina, but we also had volunteers that stayed here so that if there were a house fire, somebody would be able to go and help with that.
So even though you live in a small town like Brookings, you could volunteer and end up being flown across the country to help out at Michael or something like that.
Yes. In fact, we had a couple from Gold Beach that just got back. We still have another person from Gold Beach who is on her way back. I'm not sure if she'll get back Saturday or tomorrow or Saturday. And then we have others who are thinking about going to Michael. We're going to be there a while, so we'll have opportunities for people to go. We ask for people to go for a 2-week time period. And we do that because we're paying for them to get there. So we're paying for their flights. We're paying for their room and board. We provide a mission card so they can get incidentals if they need to along the way. Most of the time, once they get to their location, their meals and stuff are all taken care of, but sometimes they may get back to the staff shelter and the meals are done, so they may need to get them buy a meal. So they have a card so that they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we provide all of that. That's why we ask people to go for at least 2 weeks, because
yeah.
it's a pretty big expense
right.
to get
right.
people there.
And you need some time to even get up to speed. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I will let you know, it's not a vacation. Once they're there, they're working 12-hour days.
Yeah.
And they're working hard. But I can also tell you, when I speak to a volunteer who's come back, they say it was the most rewarding thing they've done.
I hear that all the time.
Yeah. So
yeah. Let's take a side trip just in terms of you, Denise. How did you get involved, and what is your role?
So I actually worked for the Red Cross in Texas from like 2011 to 2015 as a fundraiser. And then when I moved to Oregon, I moved here to be near my daughter and grandchildren. I didn't work for them, but I started volunteering with them again. Mm-hmm. They were having a big fundraiser for the wildfires in Oregon that year. And in that, I met the executive director of the Southwest Oregon chapter, and they had a job opening. She told me to apply. I applied, and here I am. Mm-hmm. I am glad to be in volunteer services. I really enjoy working with the volunteers and getting their stories and why they are part of the Red Cross or why they want to be a part of the Red Cross. It's interesting to hear people say that they want to make a difference,
mm-hmm.
That they want to be a part of an organization that helps everyone,
right.
and regardless of race, religion, political affiliation, it doesn't matter. We don't care. We help you. Income doesn't even matter. If you are in a shelter, and you could be a millionaire and still be in one of our shelters, and we really don't care. We don't care if your house burned down and you may have plenty of money, but you may not have access to it at that time. So we're going to help you because that is what you need at that time.
Right, right.
So we don't ask about citizenship or any of that. We just help people who are in need.
And you're a senior recruitment specialist for volunteer services. So you do recruiting of volunteers. I mean, you're the person they talk to get their questions answered and all of that.
Right. And I'm actually in the area today because I am promoting a volunteer recruitment event that we're having in November 2nd and 3rd. It's called Zero to Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what we're going to do is take people from filling out the application all the way through training, so that by the time they finish on that Saturday, they will be trained to be a disaster action team member or a sheltering worker. And then we'll let them know what other trainings are going on so they can get more, but they will have the basics done that weekend.
So what kinds of things will they be learning? I mean, those are broad topics, I think.
Right. So that first evening on Friday night, they'll come in and we will fill out their volunteer application. It's an online application, so we'll have computers set up for them to do that. And then we will give them the Cascades Region overview.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cascades Region is all of Oregon except for one county that is in Idaho, and then Southwest Washington.
Okay.
So it's a pretty big area, but we tell them what we do in that area, what services we provide, what volunteer opportunities are available, and what we need in like this specific area. On Saturday, the disaster action team members will go through, and sheltering too, will go through a course called Disaster Cycle Services Overview. So they'll know what our disaster cycle is, which is respond, recover, and there's another R word. But We had, so it's a three
thing three-legged
cycle.
Thing.
And like now for Michael, we're responding.
Mm-hmm.
And then relief, I think, is what the other one is.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll provide relief. So they'll learn what those that cycle is.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll learn what services we provide. So we'll tell them, you know, that we provide lodging and shelter and, lodging, clothing, and food, initially. And we'll tell them what our parameters are. We'll tell them, you know, what they're looking for, what their duties are when they arrive at the scene, and those kinds of things. And then we'll get them through so that they'll know how to do to issue our client assistance cards and to work with that system some, because it's, again, computer. They have to go in and put in some stuff so that they can get that card and have money actually put on it and authorize the funds to be released, basically, to those people. And then in sheltering, we'll teach them what we do in a shelter, how we initially are going to set it up. So what do you have to do when you begin, which put out signage and, you know, contact the shelter people and or the people who own the facility, because we don't own the facilities.
Right.
We have agreements with local entities who do have those facilities. And then we talk to them about, you know, making sure that they've marked what's off limits to people and those kinds of things, setting up a table for registration, setting up the shower areas, the different cot areas where people can eat, because we have where people can eat and where they can't, and those kinds of things, and being ready to take in the evacuees when they come, and what that looks like. And then, you know, if you're on a day shift at a shelter, your responsibilities are a little bit different from if you're on a night shift at a shelter.
Uh-huh.
So someone's always awake at a shelter. So it's just knowing what that cycle is like and what you're going to be doing when you're at the shelter, what information you can give out. You know, we talk about the fact that if we have someone in our shelter and someone comes asking if they're there, they can't give any information because, you know, we don't know. We can say they can leave a note, and if that person's there, they'll get the note and they'll...
Then they can respond if they choose to.
Right.
Yeah.
But
so it sounds like all of the sort of physical necessities are being looked after. But I imagine when you have a shelter under an emergency situation like that, or even an individual homeowner losing a home, there's the emotional impact of all of that. Do you help people understand how to be there for each other and how to facilitate calmness? I suppose, you know, you have some individuals show up at the shelter that have emotional problems and they're creating chaos.
That's a great question because we actually have a need for both nurses and mental health workers. So we have our disaster health services staff who are on call here just for a local emergency. If someone's house burns down and they lost all their medication or their walker or their cane, then our nurses will get a call and they'll get those things replaced for those people. But we also have mental health services. So in a local disaster, say there was a house fire and someone lost a pet or something, and they're dealing with that emotional trauma, or even if we notice that the family just doesn't seem to be coping well, then we'll call our disaster mental health people and they'll give them a call and just be someone to talk to. On a big disaster like Michael or Florence, we all have a nurse in every shelter. Mental health will probably be there too, depending on how large the shelter is, because we know people need to talk and people need to start getting.
So these would also be people that are professionals in the community but are volunteering to show up when
and
you
would
them.
Be amazed how wonderful those people are, because they do. They volunteer and they go for 2 weeks and give their time, or three. I know because in Hawaii, we sent a few people to Hawaii, and we asked for 3 weeks then because it's more expensive and takes longer.
Yeah.
So we have wonderful professionals who will give of their time and their, you know, their licenses and stuff, and they'll come and they'll help us in our shelters, even just, like I said, in our local disasters that happen, and be there to help those people through. It's a wonderful thing to be able to have. Disaster mental health, we use a lot whenever there's a shooting somewhere, a mass shooting. Our disaster mental health workers will go to those places and help there. So it's things you wouldn't even think about. You know, I need people who are good with financial things. I need fiscal reviewers, because we review every file, every case that we have. We have someone else look at the financials of that to make sure that things were done according to our procedures and done according to our parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're dealing with donor dollars, so right. We want to make sure that we're using them correctly.
So this event that's coming up, is this in response to the fact that we had such a horrendous fire? Or is it sort of just in the normal course of things? Are you going around doing them in all these different areas, or is Brookings special in some way?
Curry County is special.
Uh-huh.
Because of Chetco Bar.
Okay.
We had very generous people with Chetco Bar, and people who received our services then. I know that they're getting additional funds from that. But we also wanted to be able to expand our ability to respond the next time there's a Chetco Bar. I think Curry County was very fortunate this summer that the Klondike didn't turn in. While I know it burned a lot of acreage, it didn't affect a lot of people's homes.
Yeah.
But that could change.
We got lucky.
Yes. So next time, because we know there will be a next time, I don't know that conditions are going to change so much that we're not going to have another fire. It would be great. Let's have a really wet winter, you know, but we want to be ready for the next time to make sure that we have the people in place locally to immediately open that shelter. Doesn't mean that other people won't be coming from other parts of Oregon to help. No, that's not what it means. But it does mean that when the initial event occurs, we want to have enough people to open and staff the shelter for 2 or 3 days before someone can get to,
someone, can get here. Yeah.
Right. What if we had an event this winter where the landslides were really bad and we needed to open a warming center, a warming shelter? Then we'd really need to have local people to be able to do that, because if the roads are closed, who can come help? You know, it would take longer. So having local people is the key to what we do. I am a Red Cross staff person. We don't have a Red Cross office on the coast. There are lots of places we don't have Red Cross offices, but that is done intentionally, because the overhead of those offices would not help our mission.
Right.
Because we are 90% volunteers, we can still have a presence in the community without having a building or an office. And those people can still help us to deliver the Red Cross mission anywhere. And that is why volunteers are so important to what we do.
Yeah, boy, you just brought up so many different threads I'd like to follow. The Chetco Bar fire was horrendous, and it was amazing the amount of people that did show up to help out, and we were very lucky. And I guess the projections are that we're going to keep having those fires. I don't know how much you're up to speed on our particular situation. But I thought, oh, great, you know, at least we have a fire break with all this burned timber. And somebody said, no, actually, it's going to be worse because that burned timber can go so fast. Mm-hmm. You know, the stuff that didn't burn completely is just sitting there as fuel.
Right. And that's, I mean, and I really don't know much about land management or any of that. But I do know that, you know, we have a recipe for it to happen again. And, you know, even if you think about, oh, well, let's go clean it up. Do we really have the resources to do that?
It would be horrendous,
Yeah. And so, because how many acres are we talking about just with Klondike?
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Redding fire was horrible. So that, I would love to say, oh, we won't have that event again. But we both know that we probably will.
Yeah.
So let us prepare and have the infrastructure in place so that when it happens again, we can do what we need to take care of the people who are affected.
Yeah, and I remember I've been coming to this area for about, 30, 40 years now. And I would come around Christmas to visit my family before I actually moved here. And I would get stuck because there'd be, you know, the Smith River would be overflowing 101 to the south, and there'd be landslides on 199 to the north. The same thing, the road would be closed for slippage or some reason, and you couldn't go home, which meant you couldn't get in or out. You couldn't get food in or anything like that. I mean, luckily, those things would be corrected usually in less than a week, but they wouldn't necessarily be corrected that quickly. And pretty fast, you start running out of food in the supermarket and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's not just fires. There's lots of ways we could be thrown back on our own resources in the long run.
Right, there are. And, you know, so with the landslide, what if you lose power? Then we need to come up with a plan where we can, as a community, be resilient and take care of people and those kinds of things. It's, you know, we teach at the Red Cross preparedness. So that's another thing we need volunteers for, is to help us go out and teach preparedness to people, because we want people to understand that there may be a time when you have to depend upon yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you need to be ready for when that time would come, you need to have things in your car to take care of you. You need to have things at home to take care of you. The Red Cross, in most places, we say stuff for 3 days. Here, 2 weeks is probably a better.
Yeah, I imagine that's about right.
Yeah. You need to have food and water for 2 weeks. Remember, your hot water tank holds water. Mm-hmm. That's clean. So you've got that water. But just people have to think about what they're going to do if there's no one that can come and help them and take care of them. Even in with Michael now, you know, they're talking about, it's going to take us a while to clear the roads to be able to get in to the people who were severely affected. And, you know, that's why we told people to evacuate, because we knew we wouldn't be able to get in while the storm was going on or even immediately after, because you have to make things passable and safe. So that's what the hard part is. And we need to be prepared. So at the Red Cross, we teach being prepared for everything from a house fire to Cascadia. So,
With the preparedness, do you assist communities in figuring out their emergency plans, that kind of thing? Do you have resources along those lines?
No, we do have some Be Ready things for organizations and businesses to go on, and it gives them a checklist of what they need to do to be ready. I don't have that the website for that on me, but we do have that for businesses and organizations. So we would encourage a city to look at that, just to check off the list. Have we thought of this? Did we do this? Do we have these things? And organizations like schools or even a business, because 40% of businesses fail after a disaster.
Really? That's interesting. It's tragic.
Yeah, it's tragic. But if they had prepared and known what to do, then they might not have failed after.
Can you just tell me more about that? How would they prepare?
Well, and I haven't looked at Be Ready in a long time. I knew it better when I was a fundraiser, actually.
Sure, but in the broad strokes.
Yeah, broad strokes. It's about, you know, what are you going to do for your employees? What are you going to do for your business? Do you have some backup funds? Do you have backup, even a generator, so that you could still run while things were, you know, if you have a restaurant and you don't have a backup generator and your refrigerator goes out and you lose all the food,
right?
What are you going to do? Do you have a plan for these things? Because if you don't, then when that event occurs, it's going to hurt you really bad. I mean, if you have a lot of fish or meat in a freezer and you lose it all because you didn't have a backup generator to keep your freezer going, or you didn't have a plan to get that stuff to keep it frozen or keep it at the right temperature, then you couldn't even come back even once everything. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. It's a lot of the same kinds of things that an individual has to think about.
Yeah, it is.
But so me being pretty naive in this area, I have a hard time sort of wrapping my mind around, okay, I got to have a generator and I have to know how that actually works and have gasoline that's been changed out often enough and all those little things to think about.
But if you can't have a generator, at least have the things so you could build a fire.
Right.
So have matches. Have something that you know is going to start a fire. Have canned foods that don't have to be
refrigerated.
Yeah. Have the pull-top can so you don't have to have a can opener, although many multi-tools have can openers and things on them. And start building. So if you haven't started and you're thinking, oh, I need to get a 2-week supply of food and water and things that I might need, oh, that's going to be really expensive. Well, start and add a couple things every week. Mm-hmm. To your thing. Don't make it be this huge outlay of money. Make it be simple things. Go to Dollar Tree or the dollar store and get some things. Do you have a warming blanket? Do you have a tarp where you could make some shelter so if it's raining, you can stay dry and warm? Mm-hmm. You know, those are the things you have to think about. What kind of layers do you have to keep you warm? In your car, do you have water and granola bars and a blanket in case you were stuck somewhere?
Right.
Those are simple things to do.
And I know, like, this time of year, I say, okay, we're going into the winter. I got to make sure I got the firewood together. And what other things are coming up? You know, it's like time to kind of downshift from summer. It would be a good time to have, like, an annual review of what your stash looks like, and are things getting too old and need to be switched out, that type of thing.
Definitely. And, you know, bottled water is great, but you don't want to leave your bottled water in the sun, and you don't want to, you know, because plastic. But there is such a thing as a life straw now. And so with a life straw, it actually has a filter in it. So you could drink water from any source through that life straw, and it's going to clean it and make it be good enough. But if you don't have a life straw and you can boil water, then you know you can have good drinking water from wherever. You're lucky about water here because you have many water sources, but you have to be able to make sure that they're pure and okay for you to drink. So there are different things out there that can help you. And, you know, but just chlorine bleach, too, can do that in, you know, not just a few drops, but that can clean your water. So there are some things that can be done that are easy. And we do have, and they'll be giving them out at the Brookings Preparedness Fair this weekend, but some stay-go kits that talk to you about what you need to have. Because you need to have your health records, too, and your prescriptions. You need to know what they are in case you do lose them all. So you need to have those things that can easily go with you in plastic so that you have it to go with you if you had to leave quickly.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the preparedness fair.
So in Brookings this weekend, they're having a preparedness fair at the elementary school in Kalamaposis.
Yeah. I won't be able to say it. Kamiopsis?
Yeah, Kamiopsis.
I can't.
Okay. They're having that there. I believe it's from 9 to 2 or something like that, 9 to 4. And they're going to have people talk about different things you can do to be prepared. They're going to have people that are giving things away for preparedness. The Red Cross, like I said, will be giving out the stay-go kits, either way. But we'll also be giving out our preparedness guides, which in the preparedness guides, it tells you what to do to prepare for different emergencies, like an earthquake, like a tsunami, like a wildfire. But on the back, we also have, in case you didn't know, we provide free smoke alarms to people. And we have the number and email address that you can call or go on to and email us and let us know that you would like smoke alarms installed. And then we have volunteers who will go out and install smoke alarms in your home.
That's great.
And we do that because we want people to, we are trying to decrease fatalities and injuries in home fires by 25% over a five-year period. We have saved 464 lives or 448 lives to date with that program that we know we can trace back to the smoke alarms we installed.
That's amazing.
So, and it's free. So just call us and we'll do that for you. If your smoke alarm is 10 years or older, it needs to be replaced. And it's not about the batteries. It's about the sensor. So that's
right.
Why
it's
they
not
need.
Just replacing your batteries every year, but the thing itself can go.
Yeah.
So. Well, I wanted to ask you, too, we have been talking a lot in the community about our homeless population and it's coming to winter time. Do you folks have policy where the homeless are concerned or programs that are dealing with that and separately or just as part of your general outreach?
So in our service to the armed forces, we have a program called Totes of Hope where we give out like tote bags, backpacks to homeless veterans with things in it that they need. We also try to work with veterans to help them find the resources. But a lot of times, you know, it just, we're trying to help them at whatever point they'll let us help them.
Right.
As far as homeless, we don't do shelters or anything for them. But we know, like when we had the shelter open in Grants Pass and stuff, we did have some homeless come in and take advantage of our shelters, because we don't ask a lot of questions. I mean, we try to help them get out and find a way. When we close it, it's because the level three has evacuation levels have gone down. So then they have to go back out. But we're not going to turn them away when they're there at any shelter that we open because they're part of the population and they're going to come in. But we do know that sometimes it's just the homeless that we're taking care of, or, but, you know, it, we're not equipped to open shelters just for homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
But when we have a shelter open, we're not going to turn them away.
Right, right. It's beyond your
our
parameters of
yes.
what you do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, you were talking about reuniting families. Does that interface with the whole kerfuffle going on about the kids being separated at the border at this point? Are you part of that?
We have been there and have offered our assistance in whatever way they want to use it. We will try to help families get reunited. Again, one of our seven principles is impartiality, so we're not going to choose sides in any battle, but we'll be there to help whoever needs our assistance in being reunited with their families.
And I wanted to ask, too, we've been talking about our local area and so forth, but Red Cross does things all over the world. You talked about vaccinating children in other countries. Can you talk a little bit more about that kind of international outreach and what's going on there?
So our measles vaccinations, we want to wipe out measles in the world because we know it's a killer.
Yeah.
So we provide the funding. We don't have a lot of people who are there actually doing it, but we work with other partner organizations like WHO and things like that to vaccinate the children. We will help in any country that invites us to help. So, like, I know when the Philippines had their earthquake typhoon, they asked us to come in and help, but they asked for very specific help. They asked for communications help, because that was what they were needing at the time. Most countries will use their own volunteers to be in the communities because mm-hmm. they know the people, they know the traditions and the culture.
Right.
So they don't really need us to go help with that. They'll ask for very specialized people to come in and help with different things if they need it. So we will, though, help with, like, earthquakes in other countries and the tsunami that just happened. When they ask us to, we will be there. And, like, the Restoring Family Links program I was telling you about,
uh-huh.
I had a personal experience with it when I was in El Paso. We had an elderly woman come in, and she was from Germany originally. She was, like, in her 80s. And her sister in Germany, who still lived in Germany, her husband had died that January. This lady came into our office in March, and she hadn't been able to contact her sister mm-hmm. for that 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And she was very worried and concerned. Through the German Red Cross, we were able to do a health and safety check, and they found a sister and reconnected them.
Uh-huh.
So it was wonderful to see that because of our partnerships with other organizations, we can help families reconnect like that.
Sounds great. One of the things that seems to have slipped between the cracks lately is Puerto Rico, which was, by all accounts, pretty awful. Are you folks still involved in Puerto Rico, and what's the status there? Can you bring us up to date a little bit?
We do still have people in Puerto Rico still helping. I don't know exactly what the status, but our people that are there helping now in that disaster cycle is in the recovery stage.
Uh-huh.
So we still have people in Puerto Rico helping with that, and we still have people in Houston helping specifically with Harvey because those things were so long-lasting and far-reaching. So in the recovery phase, which we'll tell you, we're not exactly experts there. We're getting to be more experts just because all these big events mm-hmm. have more of that with it. But we tend to take the monies that were designated for those events and try to give them out to local nonprofit agencies who deal with those communities in the form of grants and stuff, so that the monies that people designated for, like Harvey or Maria, go to those people and those communities, because we are going to honor our donors' requests, and that's where they wanted it to go. So we're going to make sure it gets there. It takes us a little longer sometimes because, like with Harvey and Maria, there was so much money that came in, but because of taking the time to rebuild the infrastructure, especially in Puerto Rico, we want to make sure that the people that were meant to get it are getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to take our time about that and make sure it's going to those right people. I believe they still have some power issues in Puerto Rico, but we are still there helping and working with those communities to get things back on track.
You know, it seems internationally, but also especially domestically, we've had so many hurricanes, so many things happen lately. Is Red Cross feeling pressure financially or otherwise to be able to keep up with everything?
I must say that we are so fortunate to have the most generous people in the United States, that I think in the world, because when these things happen, we see that come through. And I had someone ask me yesterday, so where do you get most of your money from? And I'm like, it's from that person who sends us $5 or $10 every month, religiously sends it to us, or even like in this, having people text to we have a texting site that they can text to and give money. I know this weekend at the Ducks game, Nissan has they're going to have a Heisman house there, and people can come in and donate. We're going to have instructions for how they can donate. And people do that all over the country. And it's amazing how they truly help us in this time. Volunteers come forth amazingly. So while we're doing a recruitment event in Salem tomorrow to get people on board quickly and to get them deployed to Michael, in where Michael's happening, we have event-based volunteers that will have come through our system, and we'll train them there on the spot to help us be sheltering workers there. So yes, we have a lot of people that are going. I mean, we have 13 people now who are either already in Florida, Alabama, or Georgia for Michael, or will be by the end of tomorrow. So those are 13 people from Oregon who are going to help with Michael. And that's a pretty amazing statistic to have that many volunteers. And we have them come. So just imagine, that's just from Oregon. All the other states have those people too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful thing. We have 31 people from Oregon who are still in South Carolina and North Carolina.
Wow.
So that's a lot of people to have to go help with those things. But we are very fortunate that we have the volunteer base that we do, because even while those people are deployed, we still have people here who are taking care of the daily things that have to happen.
So I guess we're getting fairly close to the end of our hour here, and I want to make sure that everybody grabs their paper and pencils and are ready to take down whatever contacts you want to give us, resources that people can go to, and more details about the events that are coming up.
Okay.
Any last thoughts about what you would like to get across to the Brookings folks listening?
I just want to say that with the Chetco Bar Fire we had some of our best volunteers come out of that event who came and joined us then and started their volunteer time with the Red Cross because of Chetco Bar. And I think they would tell you that they would love to have you be part of their group because they do know that we need to be ready for the next thing that's going to happen. And the more people that we have to serve, the less taxing it is on any one person.
Mm-hmm. Sure is. And you also do, before we leave off entirely on the content here, the blood drives are part of your outreach too, is that right?
Yes. So we collect blood. I know we have them regularly here in Brookings,
blood drives.
And the deal is, I said we collect about 40% of the nation's blood supply.
Right.
That we're the largest single collector. That's the largest amount that any one group collects.
Uh-huh.
But that blood, so every time you give a pint of blood, you save 3 lives.
Wow. And how does that work?
Well, it depends on what the blood need is. So hospitals have gotten much better about how they use blood products and things, so there's not as much going to waste as there once was. What I love about giving with the Red Cross is we have a blood app, blood donor app, and once I can follow my blood journey to see where it's gone. So I've a couple of times I know that my blood went to a hospital in San Antonio, California, and one in like San Francisco. So it's nice to know, hey, yeah, my blood got to wherever it was going to go and somebody used it and I helped them.
That's great.
Isn't it?
Yeah, really a nice thing to have.
It is.
So let's do the contact stuff.
Okay.
Who to go to, what websites, all of that.
So anyone can go on to redcross.org and sign up to become a volunteer or to give a donation if they like. If you want to reach out to someone in volunteer services in the Cascades region, you can send an email to volunteer.cascades@redcross.org. And we're having the event on the 2nd and 3rd. You could come to that. We would be happy to have anyone come. And if they don't want to go on before that and do the application, we'll walk them through the application that night. We'll have computers set up for them to do it. They can contact me directly. My email is Denise, D-E-N-I-S-E, .Juarez, J-U-A-R-E-Z, @redcross.org. Or they can call or text me at 541-357-1897.
Great. And again, the event is going to be on the 1st and 2nd of November. Did I get that?
2nd and 3rd.
Second
it's a
and
Friday
third.
And Saturday. It is going to be at the Curry Public Library in Gold Beach. I don't know if you've been to that facility.
It's beautiful.
It is gorgeous. And it's a great place to be. I'll have food for you. So food on Friday night, breakfast and lunch on Saturday. So please come and join us and become a volunteer. I know some people will ask how old you have to be. We'll take 16 and 17-year-olds. Well, anyone over 13. 13 and that age, we'd have to find just outreach things for them to do, but 16 and 17 could actually be on our disaster action teams and could respond here locally. They couldn't go to like Michael or anything until they're like 18, but we'll definitely take them on as 16 and 17-year-olds and mentor them and get them on our teams.
That's great. And then what about the oldest generation that maybe are not as mobile as some of the people that are in the action, but do you have work that they could do to help out?
Oh, most definitely. And you know, our retired folks are very important to us. And actually, a lot of them are out there that are 60s, 70s. But even if they're older than that or they have mobility issues, we have lots of volunteer things that can be done from home. You know, much of the casework I was talking about. So we have casework for our service to the armed forces, but we also have casework for our disaster action teams. So we follow up with those families after they've had a fire. And we would love, people can do that. As long as they have a phone and a computer, we can pretty much get them to do something for us.
That's wonderful, because there are so many people here in this community, you know, we're tired and we want to do something meaningful, feel like helping out in this way would be really great. And what if somebody wants to learn more about the blood drives and how to participate in that? Do you know the local connections?
Or? Well, all they have to do is go to redcross.org or call me or something, because I recruit for the blood too.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, I can set them up with, Laura Lubich is actually our engagement person here for blood. But she would be happy to have more people who wanted to be blood ambassadors or transportation specialists.
Blood ambassador, that's the host role?
Yes. And
get people in and get them oriented and all that?
Yes.
Sounds great. Well, this has been a really fabulous interview. I'm so glad we were able to make it happen. And Denise, you're based out of Eugene, is that right?
Yes, I am based out of Eugene.
And then you're coordinating for this whole area all the way down to here?
Right. And actually, my title has changed. I'm now the engagement specialist for the region. So I cover the whole region, Southwest Washington and all of Oregon. I'm going to be down here for the second and third, and I like this part of Oregon.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is gorgeous and friendly.
Yes.
So wonderful. I really appreciate you coming on board and everything you've had to tell us about, and I do hope that everybody can show up for this event. The hours are going to be what to what?
So on that Friday, it'll be 5:30 to 8. Mm-hmm. And then Saturday, 9 to 4 or 5, depending on when the instructors close up their classes. But come a little early and have some breakfast and then get in your class.
And learn a lot of wonderful things without a charge to learn them.
Yes, no charge.
That sounds great. Well, again, thank you for coming on board. We really do appreciate your time and all the great information. And thank you very much for listening, everybody. This has been Denise Suarez for the Red Cross and Lee Tooley, your host. We have Pi White as our technical support and co-producer. And thank you all for listening to KCIW.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.